And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Friday, April 26th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, is the artificial intelligence leash on federal agencies maybe a bit too long? Plus, inspectors general back legislation to keep an important oversight tool alive. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, Army officials say they're in the middle of a series of sprints to figure out how to incorporate artificial intelligence into acquisition programs. Once a 100-day plan is finished, officials say they hope to have a list of concrete actions they'll take. And they've got two objectives: to let the Army develop its own AI algorithms in a process they can trust, and to bring in third-party algorithms in a secure way. Federal News Network's Jared Serbu has the details.
There are initiatives throughout DOD that are focused on things like identifying the most compelling use cases for AI and making sure the department adopts the technology responsibly. But for the Army's acquisition community, a big part of the current 100-day implementation plan is identifying the factors that would get in the way of AI adoption. Young Bang is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology.
We're aligning with everybody to look at the table stakes stuff. But for us, we're looking at what are the other obstacles, just like the software directive, what are the obstacles that are going to prevent or make adoption of AI a little bit harder for the Army or the DOD at large? And that really is essentially three sprints to codify setting the conditions for that, for the Army and ASALT specifically. That was actually signed out last month, so we're already into it. And then that also aligns with what y'all have probably heard about, that the Army is probably the first service to look at palming something very specific as a program for AI. And so there's been a lot of interest from the OSD as well as other services that are looking at, hey, is there things that we can, one, work together, or two, kind of lessons learned on how y'all are thinking about it. So we're working with all that.
Bang speaking to reporters earlier this week. Officials say wherever it makes sense, they want to adopt AI algorithms and models that industry has already developed. But there are nuances the Army needs to think through first.
One of the obstacles for the adoption is, how do we look at risk around AI? Meaning, what are the issues around poison data sets, adversarial attacks, right? Trojans and those type of things. And it's easier to do if you have developed it in a controlled, trusted environment that, say, the DOD or the Army owns. And so, yes, we're going to do all that. We're going to put all the security components and bake that in from a development standpoint, just like you would do software. But this really looks at how can we adopt third-party or commercial vendors' algorithms, right, into our network, into our programs, so we don't actually have to compete with them. We want to adopt them.
To address those issues, Bang says the Army is creating a layered risk reduction framework that it will apply to future commercial AI applications with input from commercial vendors. Officials say they've met with more than 250 companies so far to discuss AI adoption. And for the most part, the service's vehicle for buying those capabilities will be Project Linchpin, a new program of record the Army has been standing up over the past year. Bharat Patel, the product lead for Linchpin at the Program Executive Office for Intelligence, Electronic Warfare, and Sensors, says the Army is treating the project as the AI delivery mechanism for its acquisition programs.
It's literally all the boring parts of AI. It's your infrastructure, it's your standards, it's your governance, it's your process. All those areas are things that we're taking on, because that's how you can tap into the AI ecosystem. That's how you deliver capabilities at scale. And as part of standing up the program, we're doing a ton of market research. So since November of 2022, we've released 4 requests for information. We have well over 500 data points from all of those RFIs. But again, some of the fundamental things that we just have to do: how do I understand risk? How am I going to evaluate not only the algorithm, but how do I evaluate best of breed? How do I evaluate the company itself as part of the acquisition process? How do I create these long-term and short-term contracts, not one but many again, all things that we're putting on the table.
One of the most significant awards the Army has made so far under Project Linchpin was last October, when Patel's office awarded up to $2 million to Booz Allen Hamilton and Red Hat to help develop traceability, observability, replaceability, and consumability, or TORC, for the Army's nascent AI infrastructure.
So those are strategic design principles that we wanted to flesh out a little bit further to help us, again, wrap security around engaging with industry, as well as create modular open system architecture concepts that will allow us to plug and play different services across the pipeline. So basic services that any commercial pipeline or anyone has, in order for you to get after AI, you got to have some kind of way to manage data. You got to, if you're using semi-supervised or supervised learning, you got to label your data. You have to have environments for model training. You have to have test and evaluation. You have to have a deployment and a way to stig and create these secure models. And then on top of it, all of that is different, whether you're talking text or RF or imagery. All of that is slightly different tools, slightly different processes, slightly different T&E methods and approaches. We need to get after all of that. So our TORC design principles were a way for us to kind of manage and evaluate and assess the various offerings. So again, we could plug and play different components and different companies.
But the Army has already made numerous other smaller awards related to AI, largely through its Small Business Innovative Research, or SBIR, and X-Tech programs. As of now, there are 115 active SBIR projects related to AI involving 75 different companies. Dr. Matt Willis, the director of the Army's SBIR program, says many of those contracts were awarded in under 10 days.
So that really changes, again, the value proposition for companies so they can actually get in and start contributing to our mission. We have an X-Tech competition that's currently open, specifically focused on scalable AI. So again, how can we identify technologies across the AI landscape to inform Project Linchpin and other upcoming programs? You know, with the competition, again, that's open now, you know, we're offering nearly $1 million in cash prizes and up to $25 million in follow-on R&D awards. You know, we recognize, particularly through mechanisms such as X-Tech and SBIR, that the Army needs to rely on the private sector to identify these best capabilities across the AI space. And in FY25, we're predicting, you know, significant investment in our SBI, our program towards AI in particular, again, strategically aligned with Project Linchpin, you know, potentially up to or more than $150 million. So, you know, that's, you know, about 40% of the program.
Jared Serbu, Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Check out Jared's story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, inspectors general back legislation to keep an important oversight tool alive. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. As an acute threat, the pandemic departed a couple of years ago. The Pandemic Relief Accountability Committee has another year and a half to go, though. It's scheduled to sunset in September of 2025. And now a bipartisan Senate bill would help the government retain the data analytics platform so it would still be available to inspectors general. For why this all matters, we turn to the Justice Department Inspector General and PRAC Chairman, Michael Horowitz, who joins me in studio. Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here again, Tom.
And let's begin with the PRAC assets. What does it possess that should be preserved here?
There are a few things. First of all, the most important asset, of course, of any organization is its people. And we've been able to assemble a tremendously talented group of people, particularly in the analytics space. Among all the different responsibilities we have, we were given unique hiring authorities by Congress when the pandemic hit. So we've brought on a wide range of statisticians, analysts, people with great statistical skills who've helped us build this analytics platform, which is our other most important asset beyond our people, is this effort to get data from across the federal government on the pandemic. So your listeners know there were over 400 programs set up in the various relief bills that Congress passed involving $5 trillion. That's with a T, $5 trillion. It's hard to believe. And we learned pretty quickly the only way you can do effective oversight over $5 trillion of spending is with analytics.
Right. So there is an analytics piece of software somewhere, hosted somewhere, that belongs to the PRAC right. as a temporary committee.
Right. In 2021, Congress gave us funding to build this analytics platform, which we created, we've developed, we've brought in a range of data into it for these various pandemic programs. We've also entered into agreements with various agencies so we could get additional data from them so that we could look to find where the hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud occurred and make sure we can track down the wrongdoers on the one hand. On the other hand, also understand and look at the systemic issues that occurred here, which is obviously a very important part of what we've been doing as well.
So this bill that has the backing of a couple of senators, I think Mitt Romney is on the Republican side. And
Chairman Peters on the Democratic side, as well as Senator Lankford.
And it would do what exactly?
So we are scheduled to sunset the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee in September of next year. What the bill would do is, first of all, extend the existence of the PRAC beyond that. It would change the name to the Government Spending Oversight Committee, and it would allow us to keep the analytics platform to not only look at pandemic spending, continuing to look at pandemic spending, but also expand it to cover other programs as well so that we could broaden its use. And keep in mind, the statute limitations for pandemic fraud was extended by Congress for small business-related fraud to 10 years. So we're scheduled to sunset a little more than 5 years since the CARES Act was passed in March 2020. But the prosecutors and investigators are allowed to pursue the fraud until at least 2030.
So if this bill would become law then, it's almost as if the PRAC would become a small independent agency in some ways.
So we would stay as part of the IG Council, but as a different committee and an operational committee, if you will. So this would be an operational arm of the IGs that would allow us to assist all of the IGs as they pursue fraud in other areas beyond the pandemic.
Because the analytical platform, I guess, is agnostic as to what program or spending that it covers, fair to say?
That's correct. I mean, we could be using this for any purpose. And what we are looking to do and what the bill would allow us to do is use it to prevent fraud. One of the things we've been able to use it to demonstrate to policymakers is how agencies could have taken steps and how Congress could have taken steps to put in place stronger controls to prevent the fraud before it occurred.
Sure. We're speaking with Michael Horowitz, Inspector General at the Justice Department and Chair of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. And we've been through this before because the spending for the 2008 housing financial relief, a mechanism was created and it was disbanded. And I believe early on PRAC said, I wish we had what they had built in 2008.
Right.
So in some ways, it sounds like this is an effort to prevent that from happening.
That's exactly right, Tom. When I became chair of the current committee, one of the first things I did was reach back out to the folks who ran the Recovery and Accountability Transparency Board, which was created to oversee the funding during the financial crisis in 2008-09 going forward. One of the things they built was something called the ROC, the Recovery Operations Center, an analytics platform that was tremendously valuable. When I became an inspector general in 2012, I was on this recovery board and I saw it work. Well, when 2015 came around and the recovery board was scheduled to sunset, just like we're scheduled to sunset, we as IGs, the Comptroller General, Gene Dodaro, went to Congress and said, and to the administration and said, you should keep this analytics platform. In fact, GAO has a report out there in 2015 your readers can find on GAO's website that lays out the case for it. Unfortunately, neither the administration nor Congress did that. Fast forward 5 years later, the pandemic hits. We don't have an analytics platform. And yeah. Congress has to invest $40 million in 2021 to have us rebuild it.
Only the memory of Earl Devaney to try to inspire you, but not the money or the platform. Right. Well, you had the money, but not the platform.
Not only the memory of Earl, I had a chance to talk to Earl about it. He gave me the download on what worked and how it worked.
And in this case, the funding came fairly late in the whole effort because the CARES Act was 2020. Trillions had gone out by the formation of the PRAC and the funding in 2021 until you got it built. really the hogs had escaped the barn door.
You know, in 2020, when the CARES Act was passed, agencies decided they were going to get the money out as quickly as they could because of the pandemic with essentially no guardrails. It was just get the money out. And what happened, not surprisingly, is there were hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud, as well as improper payments, which we shouldn't forget. We found billions of dollars went to deceased individuals, for example, that could have easily been identified had agencies simply taken a little bit of time. We put out a fraud alert in early 2022 that went through and identified how billions of dollars in payments could have been stopped had something as simple as taking the applications and asking the Social Security Administration, are these real Social Security numbers? Do these match the names and date of births in your system? We did that.
That's a 10-second match running, basically.
Right. We sent them 2.7 million pieces of information from PPP, Payroll Protection Plan, SBA program-related applications. 2.7 million. Within 2 weeks, we had the answers back, identifying over 100,000 applications that had incorrect information in them that didn't match what the government already knew about.
And by the way, what's the current status of PRAC activity? Are you still working the platform? The staff still getting data and looking for things?
We are still working. We are doing a couple things. First of all, we're writing a playbook for Congress, for the administration, for policymakers going forward on what worked, what didn't work. How do you go forward? Hopefully, we don't have another pandemic for another 100 plus years. But we're going to have emergency spending. We're going to have hurricanes, earthquakes, you know, fires, all the things that need assistance. And we're writing a playbook for Congress and the administration so they know what worked, what didn't work, and we can hopefully prevent some of what was easily preventable here. That's one thing. Secondly, we're going to continue to go after the fraudsters. We are not going to, as I often say, we're not going to let crime pay. We can't have that happen. We're working closely with the Justice Department. We're working with over 40 law enforcement agencies to go after this fraud. And no one who committed fraud should rest comfortably at this point just because people have started to move on from the pandemic.
But didn't a lot of this fraud actually originate outside the United States? Is it beyond our reach at this point?
It's not beyond our reach, but in fact, it is among the hardest to track down and follow up on because you need to work with your foreign counterparts. I actually was meeting just 2 weeks ago with my counterpart from the United Kingdom on some of the same challenges and issues and comparing notes with them. And we're going to keep pursuing it. In fact, the Justice Department itself has been strongly supportive of keeping us in business because they need to be able to use our analytics platform to chase these funds. We're supporting almost 800 cases involving $2 billion plus in fraud, our analytics platform.
Wow. So you envision then the PRAC capabilities continuing as almost a service bureau for the IG community via SIGI?
Exactly right. That is exactly how we're trying to structure it, as well as when fraud does occur, agencies like the Secret Service, the FBI, and others, state and local law enforcement, who are pursuing these cases when fraud does occur. We want to work with the IGs to help them identify both programmatic issues and systemic issues, individual issues, but we also, very importantly, are working with OMB to understand how this can be used to prevent fraud, prevent improper payments before they occur. Because all of us know who are in this business that once the money goes out the door, you're lucky if you can get even close to 10% of it back. It's not even going to come close to that, ultimately.
Right. So the key word is not clawback, but prevention, really.
Absolutely.
You'll have it ahead of the next type of crisis.
Exactly right. Well, you have it in place first. You don't spend hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in this case, and then come up and say, let's figure out what happened.
Michael Horowitz is Inspector General at the Justice Department and Chairman of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
It's always great to be here, Tom. Thanks.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, entrepreneurship in government. Is that even a thing? But first, is the artificial intelligence leash on federal agencies a bit too long? This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. The new White House guidance on agency use of artificial intelligence It embodies guardrails, but also a few opt-out scenarios that give agencies plenty of discretion. One analyst thinks it gives them too much discretion. For more, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to the senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, Amos Toe.
I think that the OMB memo does provide one of the most robust frameworks for regulating how governments, how federal agencies should regulate their use of AI. But the problem is that this robust framework has major loopholes that government agencies may invoke to avoid the very strong and sensible safeguards that the OMB has outlined. So let's start with the good. For AI that impacts rights or safety, the OMB memo requires agencies to conduct an impact assessment before they deploy the system. During the impact assessment phase, they have to consider whether the expected benefits of the system will actually outweigh the costs, including its risks to civil liberties and rights. They also have to assess whether an AI system is better suited to accomplishing the tasks that the agency wishes to accomplish compared to non-AI strategies. So all of these criteria and mechanisms are really in place to compel agencies to think very carefully about deploying AI and whether it's suitable for that function and that task. There's also, you know, there's also ongoing risk monitoring that the federal agency must do once they've deployed the system. There are requirements for human training and oversight and transparency and providing notice to people affected by the system, as well as requiring agencies to provide options to opt out of an AI system and provide non-AI alternatives to people directly affected by these systems. So there's a lot of good in there. But, you know, there are ways that agencies can exempt themselves from these safeguards. And there are two main ways. One is obtaining a waiver when they determine that the system, like complying with these safeguards, will somehow impact rights or safety or would be an impediment to critical agency operations. And they can also define their AI systems in such a way where they are exempt from the guidance.
So, yeah, those are the two critical loopholes that you think is your beef with them, that they give agency leaders almost a little too much leeway? Because yeah, I've read that same part of the rules, and, yeah, I got a little bit of sense of the implied powers clause from the Constitution there, just saying, you know, kind of describing how leaders can make the decision if they feel the need to almost.
You're right. So the OMB memo grants chief artificial intelligence officers at agencies, which are essentially agency appointed leads on kind of overseeing the AI systems for that particular agency. It essentially grants CAIOs discretion to apply waivers to the systems and also to define whether an AI system is a principal basis for a given agency decision or action. If it is, then it would be covered by the OMB memo and the minimum practices would apply. If it does not qualify as a principal basis, according to the CIO and according to the agency, then it would be exempt from these practices, right? So that's really kind of the two ways in which agencies can exempt themselves from the minimum practices. And, you know, I think the criteria is highly subjective and potentially also overbroad, right? Like what particularly in the law enforcement context, you know, we have grave concern that agencies will seek to waive minimum practices in the name of, you know, critical law enforcement imperatives, when we've seen time and time again, when agencies don't follow safeguards, that leads to significant impact on civil rights and civil liberties.
So, you know, this is all new territory for everybody. I think I get a sense that you're not saying that the waivers aren't unnecessary, right? I mean, there does need to be some sort of escape clause for agencies if they feel the need. But what you're saying is that there should, those waivers should be under more scrutiny?
Well, I do think that there are certain minimum practices and, you know, in the OMB memo that should never be waived. I do think, for example, that the duty to conduct an impact assessment before you deploy an AI system is something that should be applied regardless of whether there are emergency circumstances or not. AI can be a very powerful tool that can have a lot of harm, and rolling it out without even, you know, an assessment of its potential impact on people and rights and safety can really lead to, you know, mass violations of people's rights and may actually be damaging to safety at scale, right? So you can imagine an agency, if they need to roll something out quickly because it's a critical agency operation that's happening in a limited time frame, they could opt to do a shorter impact assessment and do a more deliberate one later on when there is less time pressure. But to waive that requirement entirely is something that actually can lead to the opposite of what the agency intends, right? Which is that it might be even counterproductive to the operation that the agency is trying to undertake. So I do think that there are certain requirements that shouldn't be waived. For requirements that, you know, are arguably waivable, such as certain transparency requirements and kind of public disclosure requirements, I do think that needs to be really cabined to instances where the AI system, for example, aspects of the AI system, you know, may actually be sensitive law enforcement or national security information that can be genuinely classified as such, right? So we've seen, you know, a glut of overclassification of information in the government. And so there's not a lot of confidence that agencies will apply classification markings that actually adhere to both the letter and the spirit of, you know, classification directives, right? And, you know, I think to OMB's credit, they've said in some of their guidance that even if some aspects of an AI system may not be disclosable to the public, you know, agencies should make kind of best efforts to disclose the rest of the system that can be and should be disclosed to the public.
Amos Toe, senior counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, entrepreneurship in government. Is that even a thing? This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. How many times have you heard the term entrepreneurial government, or that government functionaries should act like entrepreneurs? Our next guest asks, what does that even mean? Longtime Federal Union President and Leadership Professor Bob Tobias joins me now. And Bob, I get the sense you feel that term is a little annoying to try to think that government can somehow act like, I don't know, Silicon Valley. But I've heard it many times, and I never quite knew what the heck they're talking about either.
Well, Tom, we are, as you suggest, once again hearing private sector leaders criticizing federal career leaders for failing to be entrepreneurs. And the assumption is, be like us. be brave like us and the public will be better served. I think the implication is that federal sector leaders are risk-averse bureaucrats unwilling to take any kind of an entrepreneurial risk of being creative. But I think that's just wrong. It's disparaging and wrong because entrepreneurship is totally different in the federal sector. You know, we have this thing called the Constitution and we have this thing called checks and balances. So it's really not possible to practice private sector entrepreneurship in the federal sector.
I think often what they mean is, you know, well, try to find better ways to do things. But, you know, government functionaries, government managers can't really do new things. They have to do things that they're empowered by law and statute to do according to the policies that they're given. And they can find more efficient ways to do that and more innovative ways to do that, but they can't do something different the way entrepreneurs can.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if Elon Musk wants to redesign a Tesla, he does.
I wish he would. They're getting kind of stale looking, you know, have the same car for 12 years or whatever.
You know, if he sells more cars, you know, Tesla's banks and the stockholders and Elon are very, very happy. And if he doesn't, they're unhappy. But the hallmark of federal sector leadership entrepreneurship is just the opposite. It's creativity in an environment where there's no agreement on government purpose, goals, or how to measure success. And as our Constitution requires, there's significant limitation on the freedom to design and implement proposals. So, you know, if you're a federal sector leader and you have this brilliant suggestion on how to collect more money from people who don't pay taxes or any other issue, you have to first get approval from your agency, then from the department, then from OMB, then from the president, and finally from Congress. Only the creative and persistent need apply. Again, just the opposite of the private sector flexibility. And oftentimes in the federal sector, reaching agreement is impossible because there's no agreement that a problem actually exists. So, for example, NOAA last year pointed out that there was $165 billion lost in 2023 to climate change issues. So federal sector leaders made proposals to mitigate climate change, and they went nowhere or not very far because some people in Congress believe that the earth will heal itself, so there's no problem and no solutions are required. Or consider the IRS. Everybody agrees that government debt is an issue and should be reduced. So Congress agreed and said, well, we're going to give the IRS $80 billion over 10 years to increase audits on those who make $400,000 or more. So the IRS started conducting more audits and on average got $2 for every dollar invested and $6 for every dollar invested on those who were audited in the top 1% of wealth in the country. Now, I would say, Tom, that's an entrepreneurial jackpot. Anybody who gets $2 back for a dollar invested or $6 back for a dollar invested, that's pretty good. But Congress decided to reduce the amount from $80 billion to $60 billion.
We're speaking with Bob Tobias, former American University professor and NTEU president. But that's not really entrepreneurship. That's Congress deciding on a tax policy and a government agency operational policy that they believe would produce something. But it wasn't up to the IRS to institute that policy.
Correct. That's exactly the point, Tom. If you're in the private sector, nobody would come along and say, well, the policy needs to be changed. They would only say, hey, IRS, you made more money. We're going to give you more money to collect. That is precisely the point. In the private sector, it's money. In the public sector, in the federal sector, it's policy. So calling on people to behave as though money matters is just wrong.
Well, the other thing about Silicon Valley is that it purports anyway to admire people that are serial losers even, because eventually you'll hit the jackpot. And what you don't hear as much for every Silicon Valley success story is how much money went down the drain and produced nothing for the investors. But the difference is that's the investors' money and the public isn't harmed as it is when the government wastes money.
Well, you know, failure oftentimes leads to great learning and new innovation. But there's no room for failure, as you suggest, in the public sector. If there is failure, then there are congressional inquiries, the inspector general reports, GAO reports. So there's no opportunity to learn, which, again, is one more difference between the federal sector and the private sector. You know, notwithstanding all of these problems and limitations I've been mentioning, there are huge successes, as the Partnership for Public Service points out every single year with its SAMMY Awards. I mean, this last year, there was an award for an HHS team that made some significant progress on opioid death reduction, or the NASA team that proved they could send a rocket to an asteroid and move its course so it wouldn't crash into the Earth, or the FBI team that collaborated all across the world to arrest on a single day 1,000 drug traffickers. Now, these are significant successes, but it's not the fault of the career federal employees that agency government purpose is unclear and often shifting, or that goals are hard to measure, or funding linked to goal achievement doesn't often exist. So the Constitution didn't create the executive branch to be a business. And I think that glib criticism that it should be run like a business should cease.
Right. So maybe a better approach, a better language approach, whatever you want to call it, is, yes, you should have, and I don't like the word bureaucrat, but you should have federal managers be innovative in how they carry out the programs and policies, but you can't ask them to innovate on policy and programs to begin with. That's really not the job of the standing civil service.
That is correct, Tom. There is always room for increased efficiency, increased effectiveness, and offering policy solutions, but it's not the responsibility of those federal employees to implement those policy solutions. That's not part of being an entrepreneur in the federal government.
Former American University professor and NTEU president Bob Tobias, as always, appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's a pleasure to see you.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. The Defense Department has a new office, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy, and it's got a wide portfolio. Perhaps the toughest are development and retention of the workforce. The DOD is trying to cut its cyber workforce vacancy rate by 25% next year. For how DOD is reimagining that cyber workforce under so-called 8140 policy, Federal News Network's Jason Miller spoke with the branch chief for cyber workforce development under the DOD CIO office, Matthew Eisner.
It's kind of the next evolution from the 8570 policy series. 8570 focused mostly on the information assurance workforce. This expands the scope a little bit underneath what cyber is. When we talk cyber in the department, we talk cyber security, IT, cyber operations, AI, data, software engineering. It's a much bigger audience than what 8570 covers. So that was kind of the beginning stages, but also with the amount of individuals that we are kind of bringing into the fold, we wanted to expand the scope, the aperture to be able to qualify the workforce. We want to make sure that they're ultimately being capable of doing the job that we're aligning them to do. We want to give some information to the gaining organizations across the board. So 8140 really focuses on qualifying the individuals in the environment that we're bringing them in to ultimately be able to do.
And the reason why the policy update is important and necessary is because the way cyber has changed, expanded to what it means, right? Years ago, it was, oh, you're just worried about the data center and network. Now cyber falls into so many different areas. Is that part of the reason why the 8140 policy, one, it took so long, but two, is such an important update?
Cyber, as we have learned over the last decade, touches everything. Technology touches everything. A lot of what we're doing with the DCWF, the Defense Workforce Cyber Workforce Framework, and 8140 is touching a bigger talent pool. The individuals coming up from this environment, I use the tree analogy, has a lot of STEM background. They're the trunk. They're bringing up their knowledge base, and then they specialize into various fields: cyber, cybersecurity, IT, AI data. And we need to be able to kind of work as a department and with all of the collaboration across the department and going in the same direction. So we don't need to be fighting over the same talent. We need to be working together to kind of codify what that looks like.
And you all have done that over the last year, codified that talent. I think you mentioned something to the effect of 225,000 people now fall under this idea of cybersecurity. Talk a little about what's happened with the 8140 policy since it got signed out over the last year. What some of those implementation actions that happened, and then we'll talk about what will happen in 2024 and beyond.
Yeah, so when we talk about the actual 8140, we got signed in February. We've been working with all of our stakeholders to ultimately start preparing them for what we mean by implementing. So what are we going to be doing with actually looking and making sure that their individuals are qualified. We're going to be start tracking them from a coding perspective, looking at their billets to kind of see how they align to the quals matrix, what we align from a baseline foundations. We look at three ways that these individuals can ultimately be qualified. You have certifications, you have training, you have education. That's opening the aperture. When I mentioned 8570 before, it was just solely based on certifications. This one is opening that area. We have a lot more throughput going through. So we are trying to kind of think outside the box for qualifying those workforce. So we want to be able to kind of look at that area and start really kind of honing in and start working with our stakeholders to make sure that they're implementing that and understanding where they need to go, making sure all of their billets are coded, making sure that they have identified all their workforce and start working on making sure they're qualified for those areas when we actually start kind of monitoring and tracking their per individuals.
If I could just jump in real quick, because one of the reasons why this is important is I think there's a realization that has happened over the last, again, 5-7 years that just because you don't have a cybersecurity education per se, it doesn't mean you're not going to be good or qualified to do cybersecurity or you're not doing cybersecurity. Is that the reason why you kind of expanded it to say it's education, it's training, it's certifications?
Yeah, that's one of the big fact finding that we had over the last decade is the traditional pathways was go 4-year degrees, education. In cyber, you know, the talent out there has different traditional pathways. They get certifications, they get education, they get training in other ways. A lot of our military individuals come up and don't have any of that. So there's a lot of ways that we need to be able to kind of attract the right talent coming in. We need to think outside the box. We need to be able to attract the individuals that just love building networks, that sit down in their mom's basement and sit there and start codifying a lot of these things because that's the true cyber person in the environment. And so we need to be able to kind of identify ways that we can get them into our jobs and bring that, you know, expert talent into that.
Let's go back to some of those implementation of the 8140. You mentioned, for instance, make sure people are coded while the billets are coded. That's something you're looking at, I imagine. There's some deadlines around that coming up. Maybe just walk me through a little bit of the deadlines, because I think you went through, there's a lot of different numbers, and some are doing 25, and but 26, but then again in 27. So walk me through some of the dates people should keep in mind.
Some of it's a little confusing, and one of the ways that we are going to be able to kind of tracking mechanisms is we've worked 2 years to get them in the queue, make sure they're be able to report in their manpower and personnel systems, make sure that they get us those informations. But the first staple, the first kind of mark on the date timeline is February 2025. We have 7 elements inside of the DCWF. The first one that we're going to start kind of tracking is the cybersecurity element. So any of the billets that are coded against the cybersecurity work roles will ultimately be reporting on 8140 and their qualifications. And then we'll start working through that to find kind of the lessons learned, how the tracking is going, how that, you know, kind of aligns. And then the rest of the workforce ultimately in any of the elements will start tracking in February 2026. So those are the kind of the main two dates.
The other piece of this, I think, is the curriculum, the training piece. You have to understand, okay, what do we need? What do people need to meet the certain goals under 8140? Talk a little bit about the work you're doing to look at both certifications, but training and the like.
One of the big, wonderful ways to use the framework, the DCWF, is it kind of codifies exactly what those capabilities are. What are the requirements? What are the knowledge and skills that our people need to be able to do on a day-to-day operation. So what we are able to leverage that is then go talk to our providers, so our certification providers, our training providers, our academic partners, and start communicating that. What do we want our workforce to look like in the next 5 to 10 years? And use this as kind of the blueprint and say, this is the knowledge and skills that we ultimately want to kind of incorporate. So then we go through the mechanism to kind of look at certifications and start validating the content that's in there, communicating with them. It's all about collaboration. It's one of these things, we're in it together. They're there. We're one of the customers for those areas. The academic partners are there because they are the ones training the future, the individuals coming into the next, you know, the department in the next 10 years. So we need to be able to be at the forefront to be able to communicate what those requirements ultimately look like.
At the same time, I know that you mentioned that there's some folks in the academic world already looking at, okay, what's coming up, like hypersonics or quantum? How are they starting to train the next generation of workers? Are those the conversations you're having today with academics, asking them, what do we need to make sure our sailors, seamen, soldiers, service members need to know?
Yeah, so on kind of a quarterly basis, we meet with a lot of our academic partners. We have one partnership with the CAEs, Centers of Academic Excellence, about 450 different universities. NDU runs a cyber consortium where they bring a lot of think tank individuals to it. So those are the forums that we kind of bring those things where we have the current workforce with the DCWF. We have 72 work roles inside of that. And we identify what are the work roles of critical need, what do we want our workforce to look like. But then we also get into the areas of what is the emerging technology, what are the areas of the future that ultimately might start creeping into the frameworks, into the areas of the workforce. Quantum obviously is, hypersonic is one of the areas. So we start kind of trying to game plan for the you know, next couple decades of where we're going to go in technology.
Matthew Eisner, Branch Chief for Cyber Workforce Development in the Office of the DoD Chief Information Officer, speaking with Federal News Network's Jason Miller. Check out Jason's story at federalnewsnetwork.com. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Tom Temin.